This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Jaime Blasco, who's AVP of Product Development at Alien Labs.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me. My name is Jaime Blasco. I'm AVP of Product Development, and I head the Alien Labs organization in AT&T Cybersecurity. So we are the group within AT&T Cybersecurity that work on threat intelligence, threat research, and making sure that all the portfolio within AT&T Cybersecurity covers the latest threats, and we do as much as we can to keep our customers secure. And as part of that, we do a lot in terms of tracking threat actors, discovering new threat actors, analyzing their TDPs, techniques, tools and procedures, and many times how can we anticipate what they're going to do. We can talk a little bit about that later in terms of some of the techniques we use to discover infrastructure, analyzing some of the patterns that we study. As humans, even threat actors make mistakes and they become lazy. If I'm doing the same job over and over again, I'm going to take shortcuts, I'm going to repeat the same steps all the time, and if you are able to spot those things, you can predict what's going to be next with some of those threat actors.
If we look at this from an enterprise perspective, those who've tried to take on threat intelligence feeds themselves are drowning under information. When we look at vendors have so much threat intelligence information, they struggle to actually make sense of it a lot of the time. Even when we do have the data, trying to work out the veracity, the trustworthiness, whether or not this is a false flag or real threat, is not a simple task. Where do we begin to start?
Starting with, it's very important to distinguish, like, we have a taxonomy like of two types of threat intelligence. One is tactical threat intelligence that usually has less of that problem. Is I can tell you which things are malicious. I can tell you some TDPs around how to detect particular threats. It stops there. You don't care about who is behind that. You just want some tactical information that you can use to spot those patterns in your network or your endpoints and help you prevent things to escalate. And then you have a strategic threat intelligence that is like, well, let's stop, analyze that data, and try to come up with a story about that threat actor, the motives, who is sponsoring that threat actor, is this crimeware, is this a sponsor threat actor, are they looking at me because of my intellectual property, or are they trying to insert implants in my systems for future opportunities? There is a whole process that goes into making sense of all that raw data and trying to tell the story around who they are.
We've seen a lot of efforts to get enterprises to take the raw feeds. No enterprises out there who are trying to take sticks and taxi and make sense of this. They at least are trying to put a taxonomy around this to make it easy to absorb. But that sheer volume, and as you were saying, you're trying to work out what it's doing, why it's doing, is it relevant, isn't it relevant? Given the shortage of people, even with tools like machine learning, is there any sense to an enterprise trying to understand threat intelligence itself rather than going to a supplier and saying, look, I don't want threat intelligence, what I actually want is actionable intelligence?
Absolutely. What happens in this space is you have so many people doing the same. And that's why as part of Alien Vault and now as part of AT&T, we have this portal that we call Open Threat Exchange, and it's this crowdsourced community around exactly what you describe. There is a new reporting, public reporting about a threat actor. You are able to understand that data, pull the tactical indicators of compromise in the platform, and then people can collaborate and spot maybe false positives or maybe use the tools that we offer, like passive DNS data, even the malware execution, understanding what the malware is doing, maybe beaconing to a different command and control, and using all that information to augment those indicators that have been made publicly. And then we offer a lot of tools to clean that, because as you described, it's not easy to keep up with all those indicators, and you can make many mistakes in terms of like introducing false positives, and your SOC will be overwhelmed by some of those alarms, but also spotting some of those patterns. To give you some examples, we are processing around 200,000 malware samples per day today in our systems. You can have enough humans looking at each one of those, and as you described before, I think automation plays a huge role there. We built all these systems that execute those malware samples in a sandbox environment, understand what happens from an endpoint perspective, from a network perspective, and then we have a set of algorithms that help us making sense of all that data. So instead of looking at 200,000 malware samples, we may use unsupervised learning to build clusters of activity. Maybe the system spots like 10 new malware families that then the human analyst is going to go understand what the piece of malware is doing. Is there any relation with previous campaigns or threat actors that we already know? If not, we may have a team looking at it further and augmenting that knowledge base that then we publish in the OTX platform.
I mean, part of the problem with that volume of samples is we tend to talk about it as 200,000 new samples a day. But the reality is that's not absolutely new pieces of malware. Probably 190,000 of those, if not more, are just variations on a theme. They boil down to a small set of core pieces of malware. A lot of people who are not working in a SOC, they don't spend as much time looking at this as you or I or people around us in this show. They are overwhelmed when they see these numbers. They don't see a way out of this, particularly the C-suite who are spending the money to try and get out of this. How do we reset that conversation? And instead of saying, look, yes, we get 200,000 samples a day, say, look, we see 200,000 variations of malware a day, but actually, these are the families. Because that goes back to what you said earlier, in understanding the motivation of particular groups and individuals and the malware that they are utilizing.
I totally agree. And some of the things we try to push for our customers is more about novel things. There may be a new threat vector that we have found that data. And that's something important that our customers need to know. Unfortunately, it happens, but it doesn't happen very often because threat actors are still relying on the same techniques they were using 20 years ago. They still do spear phishing. They still, exploit kits are still a thing. Adobe PDF vulnerabilities are still a thing. We came back to macros. That's probably in 2019. It has been a huge year in terms of most of threat actors out there are relying on macro-based document attacks. And it's just surprisingly boring to some extent, but at the same time, we have so many threat actors that have entered the scene in the last couple of years. And some of them have really unique attack vectors that are actually pretty cool. I think one of the trends we are looking at right now is the whole compromise of third parties or supply chain compromise. Imagine you have a software vendor. Maybe it's easier for me as an attacker to compromise your vendor than compromise you directly, and then it complicates things a lot, especially as you can imagine a Fortune 500 company may deal with thousands of different providers, and keeping up on all of those and making sure that they themselves are secure is going to become a huge issue and at a scale that is very hard to manage.
My first job was in the military as a signaller, and I was taught very early on the way I used the Morse code key would always end up creating a unique signature when I was on the radio net. And we see this when we look at developers and developer code and techniques. But how complicated is it to identify individual malware writers today when what we're seeing is an open marketplace where not just entire pieces of malware, but actually functions are being offered and people are assembling this almost in a no-code, low-code way?
It is really complicated, and when you analyze malware, you see a lot of Stack Overflow code in there. Attackers copy and paste all the time. That's the thing. The other problem is attackers sharing source code, or the moment that you have one of the big malware families and the source code is made available, it just becomes such a huge mess because like so many variations appear and it's hard to track. You can use some techniques, not just signatures, but other algorithms to try to identify just slight variations of the same code base. And there are some nice techniques. There are some interesting papers out there that you can look at. Some of those papers are also talk about trying to profile developers based on some of the binary code, some of the patterns. You can approximate some profiling in terms of at least within a short list of developers who could be behind that. I haven't seen that really scale to millions of malware samples, but as the machine learning techniques evolve, we are going to see more of those techniques working at that scale. The other day I was talking on another podcast and we were talking about what's new. I was like, well, nothing is really new. But one of the patterns that we have really spotted is threat actors, even some of the most advanced ones, they used to rely on their own tools. They will build their own tools, but that's really expensive. And the problem is as soon as we know about that, those tools are going to be burned. And you may have to spend another couple hundred thousand dollars to rebuild those tools. So we are seeing a lot of, even some of the advanced threat actors relying on open source tools because they get the job done and they make attribution extremely complicated. Tooling is one of the patterns that you use to track threat actors. The minute that they are all using the same tools, it becomes a challenge. It does make our life easier in terms of detection, though, because you have a smaller data set to work with, but it does become really hard to attribute who could be behind that particular campaign.
Attribution's not had a good story in the last year. We've had a number of attributions that have turned out to be false, a number of attributions that have turned out to be unsustainable over time, where we've noticed that people have taken somebody else's code, inserted it into there, and that's been enough to persuade people it was the wrong group of individuals. But there is a good place for attribution. You mentioned it earlier. If we understand who the threat actor is, actually we have some idea of what it is that particular group or that individual are looking for, and it enables us to inform our defense. How do we begin to look at attribution and become more convincing with it? Very little attribution out there says absolutely this group. There has to be a sliding scale. What are you seeing on that?
it's really important to start with the level of confidence. So anytime you are reporting on something, you should make really clear what confidence you have in each piece of information. And we do that all the time in internal reporting. When we are analyzing a threat, we may have low confidence because of this, and then we may be high confidence because something we have seen. It's unlikely to have high confidence these days, so we usually use median confidence. That gives you some peace of mind in terms of reporting that to other parties. Ultimately, the private industry shouldn't be playing the attribution game. I'm pretty convinced that the private industry doesn't have all the data that you need to properly attribute some of these things, especially when you're dealing with state-sponsored threat actors. Their government, it's usually much better positioned to make those calls, and they have analysts that do that not only in cyber but in other spaces. Sometimes you need some of the other pieces from other intelligences to really have the complete picture of what's going on. And again, I don't think most of the private industry really have those pieces.
If we remove attribution as something that helps inform us of what that attack might be looking for, how do we then do a better job of looking at the malware that we see to understand and not just group it into families, but to create a more coherent taxonomy? For example, at the moment, there's a lot of pieces of malware that could be a password stealer, could just be a simple Trojan for access. It could be something else, but we don't define very well. We can't defend if we really don't know what it's looking for, because it's like building lots of walls instead of just locking the one door that it wants.
One of the things that has happened, and we have been doing this for more than a decade. A decade ago, some of these less sophisticated ways of attributing really worked. And the reason was because threat actors really weren't aware of that. The minute this became an industry and we started talking publicly about it more often, sometimes disclosing it, even on purpose or by mistake, the way we do things, attackers become more aware of that. And they change their behaviors, so they make attribution more difficult. Not only that, but they started doing things like false flag operations where they will imitate another threat actor, and that way it becomes even harder to really make sense of what's going on. At the end of the day, my favorite attribution trick is always the motive. Is if you're able to observe a threat actor for a period of multiple years and you have a list of countries, industries, and specific companies they have been targeting, when you're dealing with a state sponsor, you can pretty much map one-to-one which countries have interest in those industries and those geographic locations. That's the best information you can use. That's not going to be high confidence, but it's going to give you enough confidence to have a guess, a good guess of who could really be behind or sponsoring that threat actor. The other piece of that is that makes things even harder is sometimes you will have a threat actor that is doing criminal stuff, but is also doing espionage for a particular government. And sometimes they do one thing, sometimes they do another thing. Actually, FireEye published a blog post today about one of those where these guys that have been operating for a while will be doing some operations to steal intellectual property from companies. When they get home, they will use the same tooling, the same techniques to steal cryptocurrency. That's tricky because then you don't have the same motive. You have two motives. You can look at things like time of the day that they are working. Maybe after 8 p.m., you see patterns that doesn't match with what they do from 8 to 8. There are some nice tricks that you can use there. Of course, like everything in this life, if they learn about those tricks, they're going to keep trying to fix that. The only issue is they don't have unlimited resources either. At some point, if they have some operational needs, they have bosses as well. And if the boss is telling them, yeah, I need access to that, I need this specific access or piece of information, they are time constrained as well, and they are going to make mistakes. And at the end of the day, once they make a few mistakes, if you are there to find those mistakes, you can have this database of mistakes that over time it really adds up and can help you with that attribution.
How much does the sophistication of the malware make it harder? We're starting to see increasing amounts of malware out there now that is modular. Go back to a point you made earlier. We're looking for what they want. Are they trying to do cryptocurrency mining? Are they looking for intellectual property? But we're seeing some of these campaigns where the same piece of malware will be used, and it will actually look at the machine that it's on to decide which module or modules it will invoke or download or bring from a different source. That makes it incredibly difficult to know which defense we put into place. How do we begin to adapt to that?
Coming back to the threat intelligence story, what can you use to try to trick the adversary to think that the system you're emulating is particularly interesting, but also many times out of incident response, you can actually get that information out of the victims and understand what really happened. So if you look at some reports or you are part of that incident response team, you may have access to the full story about what the attacker did in the environment, and at that point, you have access to that information. Yeah, some of the most advanced adversaries are really, really good at making sure that if they are spotted, they can clean as much as they can. But nowadays, anti-forensics is a little bit tricky due to the way modern operating systems work. There are so many forensic artifacts that it's really hard to cover every single track. Or if you are doing the right thing, that is, you have an EDR agent or you are collecting logs and sending them to outside system, you may have that forensic evidence, even if the threat actor tries to delete all those tracks.
I confess, I look at the whole industry sometimes and I feel we're on that edge of the canute moment where we're just not going to be able to hold that tie back for much longer without a significant shift on our side. I don't envy you your job. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.